Good evening, everyone, and welcome to our regular Wednesday stream. I know this is one a few people have been looking forward to after our stream on Monday with Millennial Woes.
Indeed.
Again, thank you to him for coming on. Apart from like a very slight technical hiccup at one point, that was a possibly a rather good stream. I rather enjoyed that, and I managed to hit basically all the high points I was hoping to on quite a complex and usually quite thorny topic.
Well, yeah, no, it seemed there was a very good reception to that stream, both live and in the VOD or whatever we call them these days.
Yes, it.
Which is exactly what we ask for when people enjoy the stuff that we do. Please do interact with it and like and comment and do the algorithm summoning rituals in the comments and whatnot.
Yes, I'm glad people seem to enjoy it.
And if you want to support what we do in any sort of deeper sense, please feel free to consider being a member of the channel or donating to us via the super chats or the super stickers or directly to PayPal until we get some form of entropy thing working.
Yeah, well, I'm trying to get some alternate stuff working, not having the best of luck. I also don't have the most time to dedicate to it. But if you want to support us without YouTube taking a cut, that's the best way to do it. But we are still monetized. I get all the streams started at once. I know. Everybody seems to stream randomly at the moment. But no, we are still monetized, so do send us the questions. And do send us, the support. It does help with the beer monies and stuff. We'll probably do some more shilling later. I know people don't like it when we front load it too much with the shilling. But we do like to let people filter in. I don't know, Evelyn, is there anything you've been reading recently? I know you've been kind of up, kind of stacking yourself high with books to try and get ready for your eventual book writing, as we keep hinting at. But you do have quite the reading list at the moment.
Yeah, no, I'm just knee deep in Schmidt. I finished reading Schmidt's Dictatorship the other day, which was incredibly dense, full of lots of like juristic and juridical language, but had some very interesting pieces to say here and there on the. A large part of it was about like commissioned officers. And what purposes commissioned officers serve in all these different periods of history and how they exist to essentially demonstrate certain aspects about sovereignty that Schmidt writes in some of his other works. So it was quite interesting. But we're going to, I don't know, this is maybe might be as discussion-y a stream as we possibly get this evening.
Possibly there's a few bits I want to get through, and we did cut off a lot of the preamble discussion on the stream with Woj, just because with a guest as well, all of that stuff tends to get drawn out quite
Yeah,
heavily.
because we just in the way that we work can't sometimes let it lie. It's like, oh, well, if you're going to say this, you've got to add this onto it because it's vital that if you know this one thing, you've got to know the other and another thing on top, and then you put them all together and then you understand more of it. Which is why our streams are always sort of structured in a certain manner because we're trying to go through that process in an unclunky manner as possible.
Yes, I do also see some of our returning members in the chat. Thank you, James Murray. And I also see John Morton talking about Millennial Woes' recent appearance on PQ. I believe you said that
Yes,
slightly,
I
so.
mentioned that on the stream with him the other day. That was quite a good discussion between those two. Yes, I would highly recommend.
As would I. I know people don't like too much shilling, but I will just remind people at the beginning and the end about the fact that we do run in-person events. There has been some just like general interest. Also, we will have Baz's in the top corner.
Yeah, this is Basil Vision.
This is Bazo Vision. This is the Baz area.
If you're actually so English that you are going to be within England on the 27th of May, please
Yes.
do come along to Nomos Manchester 2, an association with the Mises Institute, where we'll be dealing with all sorts of interesting elements in and around the Austrian School and the Mises Institute for an evening at a private venue with food and drink and all sorts and people who have turned up well dressed and ready to have great chat and also smoke cigars.
Yes, it's going to be a very, very
literally. Yes. What more could you want?
What more could you want? But I don't know. It's a large. The problem is with a topic as large as who are the English. It's quite hard to pare it somewhat down, really.
Yes.
The big problem here is not what we do discuss. It's really all the things that we don't discuss. There's so many like dead end conversations, and as we mentioned in the stream with Woe, we don't want to just go over studies and become buried in minutiae, claim, counterclaim. You know, become the empiricoid is not what we want to do. So really, it's about cutting to the heart of it, really. And it's about finding out, well, who have the English been? Who are they now? And is that a different thing? Because that's something that there seems to be a lot of discussion over, and a lot of the sources that we'll use a little bit at the beginning from really the early 2000s is when this whole thing seemed to flip on its head.
Yes.
And everyone seemed to go, well, of course, the British people aren't a race, because it's England and Ireland and Scotland, and it's all different people, and because we have good history, unlike, you know, because we wrote things down on, like, the Third World, that means that we recorded, you know, different peoples coming in and out of different places. That means we're not real people. And it all gets very... It all gets very, no one's from anywhere, man, very quickly.
Everywhere, somewhere, man.
Yeah, the big problem is that you end up talking, like, with nihilists and doing pigeon chess.
Yes.
And it's a discussion that leads nowhere, because the discussion about who the English are from the, you know, the quote-unquote maleftists is not genuine.
No, of course not.
There is not a genuine conversation going on. It is also mostly aimed at people who have IQs in the single digits.
Well, maybe we could leave, or we could state and then leave it stated that as far as anyone who is politically left is concerned, nations, or at least nationalities, should only exist so that they can humiliate them.
Yes.
And this is a point that Gottfried made in After Liberalism very well, is that the only reason that really German identity was allowed to survive after 1945 is that it was an important sort of hallmark in all leftist teaching, and it meant that if they could just point to Germany and go, look, you don't want to do what they did, that it made it a lot easier than having to explain what Germany was in the process.
But it's something, again, that was very intuitive, and it really is. These are some of the first and primary, really, kind of online sources I can find in which this debate seems to come out all at once as having been settled. And of course, this happened. 2001 is like year zero, as we keep talking about. It's the really the height of the Blair years is 01 to about 05.
Well, yeah, it was something you mentioned, that this sort of conversation was never really mainstreamed until immigration just became like an accepted fact of living in quote-unquote cosmopolitan society, part
yes.
and parcel, as it were.
All this stuff is post hoc. As we'll talk about it throughout, but you can't have arbitration between native populations and immigrants if you don't already have a sizable immigrant population. And really, up until the 90s even, that wasn't true. There wasn't this critical mass in which you could go, oh, by the way, you know, English people aren't a race.
And I'd have to do like somebody's comment in the chat there. We was primordial ooze.
We was primordial ooze.
We was ooze and shit.
Yeah, we was lungfish and shit, yes.
Get back in the water.
Get back in the water. You're the reason you have to go to work on Monday. Back in the ooze. But no, the article here was from 2001. It's the old kind of archived race row. Should race be an election issue? It's all from the 2001 election.
I think when Substack goes bust,
yeah,
We should steal this entire styling for whatever anti-politics becomes after Substack goes up the swan.
We'll become the proper, like, we'll just start a web.
No, I just don't want to completely steal this. Like the old style BBC News thing.
We'll it loads fast enough.
Yeah, we'll just have anti-politics written on the title and then the rest of it will just be stolen.
Is there such a race as the British? With 2,000 years of immigration behind us, we are well and truly a mixed bunch, writes Jonathan Duffy. If the challenge had been to expunge racism from the general election hustings, then it has not been a good start. It basically talks about Roger Scruton admonishing the Foreign Secretary, Robin Cook, for his in praise of multiculturalism speech the day before.
Labour rightly takes pride in respecting minorities, yet refuses to accept the existence of a British race, says the headline.
Can you imagine that? That was the Daily Mail in 2001. That was like Roger Scruton, Britain and Elegy, that Roger Scruton coming out and being like, well, of course the British people are a race. But it really just talks about the fact of, race, the Dark Ages, the Celts, the Picts. It's basically doing...
The Romans.
Yeah, it's basically doing... If I can find it. Did I close? There it is. It's basically doing this meme. What do you mean the British indigenous people? I can name tribes, therefore the British don't exist. Again, it's not something we want to debunk or debate. It's something that is absurd on the face of it. And it's the problem is the conversation never moves beyond this. Even with people...
Well, what does he mean, the Brythonics? Does he mean ones that come from the east or the west or the north or the south? Or do they carry this second name? Do they carry a different second name? It's one of those games of like how granular do you want to get? And as you said earlier, it just sort of turns into this kind of like nihilist pissing match.
Yeah, it does. So you can just see me flick through all the sources there trying to find this image desperately because I misplaced it. A little bit of spoilers there. But it does all just degrade into this and people never move beyond this discussion.
No.
It's really the easiest way is just to say that either native people exist or they don't. Very shit or get off the pot. But the talking around it here... funny because
I think we could sort of maybe just as a sort of goalpost to lay out at the start suggest that we get to say, or shall we say in your case, you get to say that you are the English because you are here in England.
I am the English.
And I don't mean you as in just like the ego, the abstract. I mean you, the material, like the recognisable white man.
Yes. The man, as far as we can tell, has ancestry that literally does just drift back off into the myths.
That's one of those ones there where I had to make sure people understand I was doing the prescriptive, not the descriptive.
Yes. Well, the one of the funny points here, and the real reason I'm going to bring this up, apart from their mention of Roger Scruton, and as a lead into what the Foreign Secretary in 2001 actually said, is that that seems to open the door to the idea of a British race, because it talks about the fact that, a group of persons connected by common descent, which it just is us.
Mm.
It is the native peoples of the British Isles. But modern Britain only became an entity with the Act of Union in 1707. And we are still a relatively young race. It's just, it's such horrendous... like sub-schoolyard semantics that anyone who engages with this framework, and I see so many people on the supposed right do it, like they do not deserve to be part of the conversation.
But the OED's primary definition for race is more specific, siding with the idea that race can transcend national borders. It classes a race as one of the major divisions of humankind having distinct physical characteristics. Couldn't write that in a paper now, could you?
No, you couldn't.
The OED comes out with a paper talking about the fact that, like, black people have different skull shapes. This is an innate and distinct physical characteristic between the two races. Instantly banned.
It talks about a hodgepodge of ethnic groups. It basically does the whole, there's always been immigration in and out of Britain. Because, we have recorded history.
Yeah. Certainly, then, the notion of racial purity among the British is a fallacy, and our multiculturalism dates back to the Dark Ages and beyond.
Actually just a lie.
Yeah, no, just like flat out nonsense.
It talks about the Celts. It's just this meme. Ah, I closed it. Anyway, it's just the meme I had up earlier.
You moved it over.
Yeah. It's just the meme I had up earlier writ large. But that's what that is. But I wanted to use what people would usually talk about forever as a starting point. Because this is the bit, really, that typifies the modern nonversation about ethnically English people. I chose the English specifically to sidestep it's very clear that the English specifically, as a race of people, are possibly one of the most well-defined, if not the most well-defined, in the world.
Excuse me. You're saying that next to Scott? How dare you?
I'm mostly saying that simply because England, as a place, and with its history, unfortunately, there's a little bit more of it than Scotland pre, like, 1200 is a little bit fuzzier.
I says you.
but we could equally just do a Who Are the Scots?
No, I know.
The Scottish are also a group of people. In fact, they're possibly even more static. The English is just a good example because there's so much about them.
Yeah.
There's so much history there, and it is as a place that became a great power. It's amazing how static their populations were, even in the Industrial Revolution. You are talking about people moving from the countryside around the city into a city.
If I say the phrase native Britons,
yeah,
we all know who I'm talking about when I say that,
yes,
don't we?
We all. It's the comment I kept seeing about this conversation, which is just, we all know who we are. Because as you notice here, the British are not a race, and Britishness cannot be defined in terms of race or ethnic background, Foreign Secretary Robin Cook was saying today. One of the strongest defences of multiculturalism made by a government minister, Mr. Cook was set to dismiss the idea of an ethnically pure British race as a fantasy. There's that term again. They're picking ethnically pure while describing immigration as necessary and desirable for the UK's economy and society.
Well, it's also the point here that there is, again, the instant assumption, as we sort of poo-pooed on the stream on Monday, that there is no such thing as multiculturalism. There is only the multi-ethnic jungle. And trying to turn around and say, well, the British race isn't an ethnicity. It's a redundancy, because they've already said that Britishness doesn't exist as a race, so how could a race that doesn't exist be measured against as being ethnically pure?
It explains itself in self-defeating terms. Oh, homogenous Anglo-Saxon society. Well, a Pict existed once, therefore checkmate atheists. Yeah.
Well, it's all right, though. In a speech to the Centre for the Open Society,
it's just that bit
London.
Here. Mr. Hay's suggestion that a second-legged term would turn Britain into a foreign land has made several remarks by leading Conservatives which have gained succour to those with racist views. He was due to... basically...
Well, William Hague, Jesus.
Good old
no,
Billy.
No, I was just pointing out below that they have...
I'm going step by step here. It's something that was really borne out, and this was during the period where Labour was in behind-the-scenes communications talking about, quote-unquote, rubbing multiculturalism in the Conservatives' faces as a political tactic.
Mm.
And it's something that they will probably not live to regret because they control the conversation, but it's something that very much puts holes in, let's say, the manoeuvre that's coming, if you keep your eyes and ears open. But yes, in a speech to the Centre for the Open Society in London, Mr. Cook was due to condemn Mr. Townsend's comments, saying this narrow view of British identity fed on myths about our island race arises from a painful misreading of British history.
We have a copy of Our Island Race downstairs, don't we?
We do, yes.
A very old one.
Yes.
It's
just funny that you have a Blair government Labour minister here making a simpering speech to, like, the Open Society Foundation. In 2000, as early as 2001, we don't really think about the Open Society Foundation as being something very recent. But here we have the Blair government essentially bending the knee and saying, we are the global citizens. The British people are not real.
Yes.
This is the real outgrowth of the fact that Britain was a completely conquered and fallen nation, that they can no longer recognize themselves as the British people. But the other part of the discussion as well that you talked about is the bending of science, which, again, I don't want to go into the competing studies, which shows that the genetic material of the British Isles has been static for the last 700 years, really.
Well, I think on a grander scale, one could say that really since the last ice age, there hasn't been not a major, major difference in regards to what's actually the people who have lived on this island. The genetics have changed more from the conditions in regards to agriculture and technique and cleanliness, more so than they have from admixture, at least up until maybe like the 1940s. Yeah, I noticed that as well. We have somebody called Cryptomancer93. He's given us a rather generous super chat here. I think that's essentially him paying for his Nomos ticket. Hey, big sad. I can't make it to Nomos. I'll catch you guys at the next event. Don't worry, we'll let you know when it's happening.
And thank you for the 50 euros, I believe that is. That's Eurobox. But thank you very much for the 50 euros. And yes, I think that's possibly the largest single donation we've ever had on the stream. So thank you.
People keep doing this.
For those who don't know, Cheddar Man was supposed to be this whole checkmate white supremacist, ancient,
in a cave in Cheddar Gorge somewhere. And I mean, I don't know what details they've got in this article because it's very short anyway. We might as well just have a little look through it because this article's quite hard to get a hold of. I had to archive and then go further back to get even the paywall version, you can't go back. You've got to go back further. But yes, a Briton who lived 10,000 years ago had dark brown skin and blue eyes. Doubt.
Oh, yeah. At least that's what dozens of news stories published this month, including our own, state as fact. But one of the geneticists who performed the research says the conclusion is less certain. But according to others who are not even close to knowing the skin colour of any ancient human, the skeleton of Cheddar Man discovered in 1903 in a cave in the south of England, where it had lain for 10,000 years. Until a few weeks ago, it had always been depicted with pale skin. This makes some sense, given that people living in northern latitudes often have paler skins. Ooh! They said the explanation may be that it allows more of the blah, 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 blah. Basically, we're adapted to being in our...
Vitamin D. Yes.
But the new DNA analysis suggests that Cheddar Man may have had dark skin. Most news stories said his skin was dark to black.
Yeah. To show this, researchers, including Suzanne Walsh at Indiana University, Purdue University, Indianapolis, read Cheddar Man's DNA. Walsh had developed a model that attempts to predict someone's eye, hair, and skin pigmentation solely from their DNA. So a mathematical model.
Yeah, they're using a mathematical model on 10,000-year-old DNA. And then putting out news stories about the fact that they have completely BTFO'd the white people and that you are, in fact, a Negroid.
Yeah, the most recent version of the model was published in May 2017. It focuses on 36 spots and 16 genes, all linked to skin colour. To test it, Walsh and her colleagues took genetic data from over 1,400 people, mainly from Europe and the US, but also from some from Africa and Papua New Guinea. So on they go on to train their thing. But if we keep scrolling down, I think they get to a point here where they're basically this method doesn't work. You can't just do this because we haven't even really proved that skin colour is...
Yeah, it now seems like that many other genes affect skin colour. We don't know how. So the weird science that they did on the 10,000-year-old DNA didn't work. Yeah. And it wouldn't work. It wouldn't work on a living human.
Yeah, this debate may seem of little practical importance, although the idea that Cheddar... Well, see, that's the thing as well. They're like, this debate may seem of little practical importance. Then why did every single newspaper in lockstep go the original Britons were black?
Yeah.
All at the same time. Although the idea that Cheddar Man was dark-skinned generated enormous public interest, however, we need to know the limitations of this sort of genetic technology. Police could one day plug DNA from a crime scene into one of these models to determine what a suspect looks like. Walsh's model might succeed at this in the US and it'll get shut down for being racist, because it was trained on DNA from people with similar ancestry to North Americans. Hens' team has tested an older model that aimed to predict skin colour from DNA. When they put it to work among Southern African populations, it literally predicted that people with the darkest skin would have the lightest skin.
So Cheddar Man was white. Certainly whiter than an Argentinian. But that was more of the preamble stuff I wanted to get through. Just to give you a snapshot of how important it is for the current elite to try and convince the British people that they do not have an ethnos. Mm. And especially populations that can be so easily proven, like the English people.
Yes.
As we're not going to be debating whether the English are a people or not in this stream. I hope people aren't disappointed by that. But we're going to talk about really what the English being a people means and what we can see from their history about how it's applied. So I wanted to really kind of take a few snapshots here, as it were, of the of British history and what we can tell from them. Just to start off with, I just wanted to mention the fact that England is an extremely long-standing kingdom. Really, it existed from the fuzzy areas of post-Roman Britain into like the 500s. We still know who was king in the 500s.
But this is also amazing. Just the nature of people groups.
Yes.
People groups have leaders.
Yes.
The peoples have elites. That means that there was always some class of recognisable English elites. And who knows, you know, how long even maybe that specific stock on its own has remained intact.
We simply don't know. There's all the mentions of tribes, but the whole thing about the Anglo-Saxon kings is that the Anglo-Saxons were the ruling class of England and were defined that way.
Mm.
It wasn't that everyone in England was a quote-unquote Anglo-Saxon. Everyone in England was English.
Mm.
And they a lot of them would have not thought about themselves in those terms.
Well, I think in a far enough back time, it would have been, you know, you were a Yorkshireman, you were from Northumbria or Northumberland. Or...
As I keep mentioning, the pre-modern world thinks of people in locations and extended families.
Yes.
You are from, if you're a nobleman, you're from the house of X, or you're from the house of Y. And as we talk about, there's a tussle between the landed elites of parts of Northern Europe, parts of Scandinavia, and England about a contested throne. And one of the more important pieces when we talk about our first snapshot, which is 1066, which is where everybody starts, it's where all the schoolboy history starts, really, is the fact that we have a tussle here between, you know, the failed heir of Edward the Confessor. You know, his half-brother comes in.
Mm.
And it's all very tenuous because Edward the Confessor does not have an heir. But there are multiple claims to the British throne. Oft-forgotten facts that both Harold Hardrada and William the Conqueror, or William of Normandy, did have distant but legitimate claims upon the English throne. And when there is a contested throne, what happens is you have military conflict. Because nobody has a very clear claim. But these are not outsiders who came in without a sense of like culture. William the Conqueror was genetically related to Edward the Confessor. But that is just, you know, it's claimed, but it's also probably true because of how the ruling classes in Europe, even at that stage, attempted to be as related to each other as possible as a means to, one, keep peace, and two, keep around viable heirs from different places.
Yep, not exactly.
The other point I have here is that we talk about 1066 in quite a vital fashion. We talk about it, you know, as something we can imagine, something we can think about, something we can envision as British and as Britain. But as the Battle of Hastings is going on, it is still 300 years until New Zealand will see a single human being.
Yeah, no, that's... This is a battle that happens 750 to 800 years before anyone even steps into the salt plains known as South Africa.
Yeah.
the idea of Zulus and all these different groups that have been there. You know, these are the things you're meant to recognise.
Yeah.
These are these some tribe of Bushmen or this, that, or the next nomadic group from the Middle East. But we have no record of them being there. And I'm not saying that empirical record is the only thing that matters, but it goes to show that, you know, to put it in perspective, we have tapestries from this time demonstrating just the facts of the matter compared to, you know, nation states that we are meant to recognise now as unique and native and different from a way that white nations are. And yet they have none of this.
No, it's... You have the belligerents, Harold Godwinson and obviously William of Normandy. But the point with William of Normandy is that he's from Normandy. He's from northern France. He's from across the Channel. He's from across quite a small body of water that was, at that point, relatively navigable. It's not like he's from a world away, yet he is recognized as the other. He has a different culture. He is, and the Normans are genetically distinct. They are visibly distinct from the Britons, even though they are quite literally just across the Channel. We're talking about the very north of France. We're talking about a man from a duchy with interlinked claims to England because it is so close. And yet him and his men and all the lords he brings over are genetically, culturally, and, you know, just in terms of recorded, they are distinct. They are distinct enough that they're not talked about as just another group of Britons. They are... the Normans. I mean, they are, see, of the Norman race.
You even think of the way history is taught now through like horrible histories annuals from like the middle 2000s that I spent my childhood reading. The Anglo-Saxons were, you know, short, wide-skulled, you know, well-built but not round. The Celts were either these round or these weedy things, and they all had ginger hair that was curly. And then the Normans are these tall, sort of straight-faced but thin folk with slightly smaller frames than the Anglos. And, you know, these were all things that were discerned both back then, and we're even still able to demonstrate to each other nowadays.
Yeah, one of the closing points, but I'll bring it up now as well, is the fact that even after nearly 1,000 years... people of Norman ancestry, you can tell them by their last names in many cases still.
Emlo.
Are still genetically distinct from other groups and other peoples in England.
Mm.
After nearly 1,000 years. That is how strong, you know, the blood is in these isles. And how strong the blood is in Europe in general.
Yep.
And in humans in general. In that it's been 1,000 years and you can still tell who is and isn't of quite strong Norman ancestry. That's just how this still works. The House of Wessex, like I said, recorded to be founded in 519 by the Anglo-Saxon Chronicles. Not quite sure how accurate that is. But it's just the fact that, like, we know from, like, 519 to 1066 who the King of England is.
Mm.
And the Polynesians haven't yet boarded, like, they've still haven't inhabited New Zealand. And those are the native peoples.
Yes.
But we are not.
No.
We who have history literally older than their race. We who have a king and recognizable borders older than the land that they settled and the land that defines who their ethnos is. We are the ones who are not a race.
Well, I mean, it's no surprise that in the same way we discussed with Panama Hat poetry, that we are so heavily disconnected from all this stuff.
Yes.
I mean, one of the things, honestly, that's been a very great sort of touchstone for me almost to that kind of world is in Carlyle's Past and Present, the second book, where he talks about the monk Jocelyn from St. Edmundsbury during the 12th century. And he goes on for about 100-odd pages describing loads of the different little intimate details of this man's life. And he even goes on to say the fact that he is, you know, we would recognise his speech, we would understand him. He would look like one of our neighbours, but he isn't because he's been dead, at least in Carlyle's time, for 6.5 centuries. So to read and sort of venerate it to the detail that he has, with the view he has on everything else sort of on top of it, it really makes you appreciate what there is to being, you know, English or Scottish or Welsh or Irish, whatever it was. In that case, obviously, specifically English. And we just do not get the ability to experience it in that way that we do through texts and education or just in general entertainment and society. There's no want for it.
Well, as we talked about the men of race, William the Conqueror is a man of race. The Normans left a huge impact on England, not genetically, because there actually is a relatively, you know, it's moderate, it's more than the Romans did, but in terms of architecture and will and rule and the idea of Britain and as a ruling class, they were able to set in motion a large amount of monumental architecture, which is one of the most lasting things we have from the Normans. It's a point I often bring up to people, but they, like, everyone just forgets that Lincoln Cathedral was the tallest building in the world for about 200 years.
Oh.
The spires, unfortunately, are now gone. The spires are what made it the tallest building in the world, because they collapsed in the 1500s. But for 200 years, Lincoln Cathedral, a Norman cathedral in England, was the tallest building in the world. Taller than the pyramids. Taller than a lot of the stuff you see talked about as monumental architecture from the Far East was built in the 17th and 18th century. This is the level of, you know, the level of civilization we're talking about here. By the way, another dunk on McChristian Dark Ages. Dark Ages, we could be in space by now. It's like, no, the Normans built the tallest building in the world.
Yeah, no, a time so dark and lost that people found it within themselves to spend generations of their families building churches they would never see finished.
Yes.
I mean, think of how many abbeys and monasteries across England and Britain on a wider sort of front all were attributed to in that kind of manner. That the sense of those people had in themselves was so strong that they thought, well, no, this will continue. And someone, once I am gone, will be there to continue building this mammoth monastery once I've popped me clogs.
And again, the Normans are considered this disruptive force. 1066 is the last time that Britain is quote unquote invaded from outside. And it comes from Normandy, from William of Normandy, who does have a legitimate claim on the English throne.
Yeah.
He is a noble with blood in England. And that is considered the big kind of changing event. There's things like the Glorious Revolution, about obviously the English Civil War, but in terms of genetic material coming from outside of Britain, until we reach the end point, which is the Windrush generation, that is the largest single influx of genetic material in those in those 1500 years.
Yep.
And it's that should be a testament to how stable the British population is in terms of, you know, being within its borders, staying within its borders, and being connected to its land as a people. Again, just looking at history will do this to you. Another point before we move on to the next kind of little area I want to talk about was the fact that, a change in the ruling house of England was not a complete change in the ruling class. A lot of lords who were, you know, declared fealty were retained. And also, it was not a change in the overall population makeup. There wasn't this, like, forced march. William the Conqueror was not Pol Pot. He came in as somebody who wanted to be seen as the legitimate heir to the throne of England. He didn't destroy the throne of England as an institution. He respected it. He didn't attempt to destroy Britain as a society. He certainly didn't go into the villages and start burning everyone's crops down. Like everyone in the medieval world, he knew that if the peasants did not bring in the crops, then everyone would die. That is the underpinning principle of medieval Europe, that you do not fuck with the food supply, and that means you do not fuck with the local populations. And at that point, the fact that the invasion happened, 1066 happened, and large parts of England, apart from having a nice fancy castle near them suddenly, and maybe a slightly different lord, you know, of their lord, most people didn't notice. It was not a seismic event in the everyday lives of the average British person.
That, no, that that is that is something that we have taken on as a given in the modern world, that it really is a very novel idea. The way of life for the average person changes immensely in a regime change.
Yes.
I think there's a little bit of Burnham somewhere in Struggle from the World, Struggle for the World, where he discusses this, the fact that, you know, in history, you know, they'd say some ancient tribe of the Greeks goes and conquers another one. It's not like they then take everyone out and slaughter them. As you said, these communities actually had to work together just to survive. So at best, or sorry, at worst, you would maybe have like a couple of like aristocrats get beheaded in a sort of honor of battle, and that's kind of like it. Everyone just goes back to their normal life. I mean, there's so many bits and other things I have read that almost paints it as a kind of comical image. Across, say, Britain or Germany or France, you have these sort of roaming bands of soldiers doing this, that, and the next thing. But whenever they turned up anywhere and wanted to do a bit of soldiering, they had to basically come to the farmers and be like, "We're really sorry, but can we use your fields, please? We're going to, you know, hack these other 20 dudes from this tribe to death. And then we're going to go and we'll take our dudes with us."
People mentioned feudalism and the changes from regionalization, but that happened over the course of hundreds of years. It didn't happen immediately.
No.
And the Norman rule was during a transitory period in Europe where all of Europe really was getting to grips with kind of the parcel land, serfdom lord, you know, peasant, freeman, which is quite fluid. But we don't have time to get into all of that. But a lot of what you know about this period is quite simply myth.
Yes.
And we don't have time to debunk all the myths of history. And the Harrowing of the North is considered quite extraordinary because it did get a bit nasty up there. But the fact that it got nasty, as opposed to what happens in the rest of England, is the extraordinary part.
Yes.
It isn't this mass bloody campaign where you have these attrition-level battles. That is not what happens in the ancient world, and that is certainly not what happened with the last, what is considered the last successful invasion of England in 1066. The next point, the second snapshot, really, because the BBC article mentioned it, really, but it is one of the most impactful events in English history, is the union with Scotland. It is the 1707 Act of Union, because it seems that the Act of Union is used very heavily in these discussions against, you know, the English as a people. Never mind that they have all this history going back thousands of years, and the last time, you know, they were invaded from outside was 1066, and that was a change of the noble class and not a complete destruction of the population. But the idea that England became, you know, the United Kingdom was an nullification of the English identity and the English people as an ethnicity is nonsense.
Mm.
And it is patently nonsense if you look at it on the face of it. I don't know, the points I've just got in my notes is that, like, this is 640 years after the Battle of Hastings. 640 years have passed in England between these two events. And you have, with a few hiccups, a relatively contiguous institution that is the English throne. It has been ruled by different houses. It has been ruled by different people. And it has been ruled in different ways.
But an institution and a crown has remained for, well, all the way back to possibly your first House of Wessex, you know, 500 AD or however one would want to refer to it.
The fact that we are able to record our history and don't just shit in mud huts is not an indictment of who the British are. And I'm sick of people like acting like it is. The fact that we know who the tribes we come from are, we know who the king was 1,500 years ago, we know the outcomes of battle 1,000 years ago, we know the machinations of the lords of Normandy and the fate of the last Anglo-Saxon kings of England. The fact that we know all this does not make, you know, our contiguous nature as a people any less true.
No.
If anything, it makes it more true because we are more aware of it.
Well, yeah, that's one of the aspects of it as well that you pick up more of as you read more about the time, is there was an unbelievable air of legalism in everything. I mean, that's basically the crux of what feudalism was. quasi private law system of society.
Yes. Brad Jepson, I'm kind of sidestepping the idea of England becoming a unified land because there's several answers to that. I would say the least controversial is after the end of the Dane law. And the kind of, like I said, the 519, the House of Wessex stuff is really when England becomes a unified kingdom. As we recognize it in a modern sense, really, it becomes a unified kingdom. But England has existed in some capacity for an indeterminate amount of time, because as I use the term in my speech, I'll quote myself in my little speech about the English liberal tradition, but a lot of English culture and history does just disappear off into the myths of Albion.
Yep.
It does just disappear off into like Arthurian legend and things about post-Roman Britain that the House of Wessex, sorry, was 519. Mm-hmm. That's what I mentioned.
Yes.
That is considered the start in the Anglo-Saxon Chronicles of Anglo-Saxon England. Although, because it's so long ago, that date is a little bit indeterminate. But again, we're not here to discuss dry facts and figures. We're here to kind of discuss concepts, which is the big thing.
The act of union does not change the fact that there are a people who existed on the same land, both the land and the people being recognisable, over a span of thousands of years.
Yes.
The fact that all of a sudden, you know, we call the legal union of the lands of England and Scotland Britain changes nothing in that equation.
Well, it's the United Kingdoms at this point of England and Scotland.
Yes.
And that is the point here, that it is a supranational union of thrones, as it were. You have the same king on the English throne as the Scottish throne, but the Kingdom of Scotland and the Kingdom of England do not cease to exist. In fact, for them to cease to exist would be a massive legal headache, and it still is. The Act of Union, again, used as a bludgeon against the English people, really shows that even though Scotland and England have been neighbours for so long, they have thousands of years of proximity in history, that they are distinct enough that the union of their thrones would be an extraordinary event that would need hundreds of years to develop a shared culture, which may or may not even exist, which is what some of the stuff that's used against Britishness is.
Mm.
A lot of Britishness is 18th, 19th century, because that's when it dates from. Mostly 19th century, to be honest.
You get the same with Scotland.
Yeah.
Where a lot of what is thought to be Scottish is stuff that, like, Sir Walter Scott basically scribbled down a bit of paper and pretended it was history.
Yeah. Like I said, all Scottish/English people did not immediately become British as a superseding identity. Now, the Scottish all then become English and the English all then become Scottish. The identities and of the peoples are retained explicitly within the Act of Union. It is a celebration of these two, you know, these two kingdoms that are able to finally, after many generations of animosity, kind of come together in this glorious union.
Yeah, and as you go on to see the end there, even 300 years after the Act of Union, there are still recognisable population different in the regions of Scotland and England.
Scotland especially, because it has not been mass immigrated in so much. But we'll take a snapshot of that when we get to our next point. But yes, even 300 years later, even in modern history, even in living memory, both, you know, racially homogenous Scotland and England were still genetically and culturally different 300 years after the Act of Union, which should show you just how sticky the culture from race is. If you guys are getting it here, we're really just saying the English are the English in more and more plain language, because it is something that has to be programmed out of you. But you go, like I said, you go from 1066 and you go to 1707, and you still have many of the same institutions, many of the same legal fixtures, and you still have many of the same ways of thinking about yourself if you are an Englishman as it was back then. England has been so prosperous. England was so powerful by the end of this period. And England was able to go out and create, you know, within the Union of Britain, the British Empire because it had this massive period of stability. And people, you know, there's, you know, English Civil War, Glorious Revolution, all of that. But this takes place over 1,000 years, all of these events. And in between it are long periods of very prosperous, stable peace. And that, those bits, the gaps between, you know, living through historical events are really what defines who the English are.
Mm.
Because they are able to live in a kingdom in which they know what the boundaries are, they know what the laws are, they know where their neighbour is, they know what the next town is, and this goes on uninterrupted for periods of hundreds of years. And that's what has been able to breed the British legal system. It's really where the British, the original kind of English liberal tradition stuff came from. It's this almost abundance of comfort from being a slightly sheltered island race that is able to not have their society collapse every 10 minutes.
I mean, this is also why Americans and like second generation white expats will just never understand what it's like to be us.
Yes.
There is a feeling to it. And as we were saying on the stream on Monday with Woes, that being of a place that your people have been of for such a long time, there is some, you know, intangible sense of feeling and feeling that you are part of something that is just, I rarely see people come to terms with in any other way, because I think we're probably some of the last people on earth that are really allowed to do it, maybe other than the French, and even then they're not really allowed to do it anymore.
No, they're not even really allowed to do it anymore either. It's kind of a shame. I'm trying to get something up on screen, really. The next snapshot I want to take comes much more recently, and it's something we discussed in the previous stream. It is the arrival of the Empire Windrush, which is the first kind of burst of what was considered at the time mass non-white immigration. But really, the Empire Windrush was only just over 1,000 people. 1,027 passengers in 1948 from Jamaica. That was seen as a scandal at the time.
Yeah, well, see, they got away with it because that's not a small boat.
That's true, yes. But the arrival of the Empire Windrush, 300 years really after, or close enough, you know, 250 years after the Act of Union, is the first mass immigration event that we can see recognized from a non-white nation. And it was 1,026 people. And that was considered mass non-white immigration at the time. By the reaction to it and by the context, you must be able to tell that this was not happening, had not happened before, and that large foreign populations were not normal in England. Just the fact that it is considered an event should tell you the life previous of England was one of extreme, both racial and cultural homogeneity. Well,
yeah, because that was something that came up in the stream with Woes and Pete Quinis, as they were sort of discussing at one point, and Pete was asking, you know, well, what happens immigration-wise in Britain during the Empire? Is there not Indians that come across? And Woes is just kind of like, well, no, of course there wasn't. That even having to contextualise this by Empire was like quite a far stretch.
Yes.
I mean, it's something maybe we'll have to go back to and do a treatment on entirely of its own. But I can't imagine that this was all of a sudden just taken as something that people should accept.
It really just shows us that right through to 1948, we have, despite a lot of the political changes and the destruction of the aristocracy, the destruction of the landed classes,
there is still a collective sense of self.
There is still an extremely powerful collective sense of self, especially just after the war, especially considering kind of where we are in time here. Britain has just essentially set itself on fire so America could warm its hands and then it is essentially humiliated by being bombarded with what is considered its empire guilt. This is really the start of the arc of the empire going from something that Britain is quite stringent about and very proud of to something it is supposed to be ashamed of, really.
And of course, as you go on to note here, crucially, immigrants cannot inherit the supposed genetic guilt of their native host population. Race exists in all frameworks implicitly. It cannot be dispersed with. So that, you know, to
dispensed
do,
with, yes.
Yeah, to do with the whole anti-colonial arguments that they engage with against what it means to be British or English, they have to, as a given, have a group of people called the English that they can refer to.
Yes, it's like ipso facto. As we keep talking about, saying that there isn't an English people is a performative contradiction. Because to do it, you have to refer to the English people and then say they're not English.
Mm.
It again, is a performative contradiction to say the English race does not exist. These people were not British citizens. They were considered at the time British subjects, which is a different thing.
Yeah, I see people in the chat saying, oh, the British government wasn't aware of it, or they weren't invited. And again, we'll have to go look into it, but I would presume that this is...
The British government had the power to send those people the fuck back where exactly. They came from, and they didn't.
Yeah, exactly, which was the point I was going to make, which is them going and putting their hands up and saying, we are powerless to do anything about it. This is one of the first tricks they go to when they are trying to do something.
Yes, it is very, very performative in many ways.
Maybe we'll make that another Wednesday stream at some point. We'll try and get some more... contemporary sources from the time to discuss it.
Yes, I just wanted to get a quick bit up. I wanted to get this.
Oh no, the N's still there.
Oh no, the N is still there. The famous N. Goodbye, N. We hardly knew thee.
But sort of a closing point for the stream.
Well, I just wanted to wrap it all up, really. I didn't want to let this stream linger on too much, because you know you don't want to outstay your welcome. But I. Having gone over all of this, having gone over the way that people thought of themselves in 1066, the way that people thought of themselves in 1707, and the way that people thought of themselves in 1948, which is they all thought of themselves as bloody English, and these are the genetically extremely similar people.
Hmm.
Like I said, you can pick out who the Normans are still.
Well, that's the thing I referenced from the Bit in Carlisle, where it's like, well. You know, this guy's from 650 years ago, but you can't discern him from your neighbour.
Yes. The English are a race with a longer and more stable history than modern native peoples who are allowed legal protection. Again, Britain has existed longer than places like New Zealand have been inhabited. So England has existed longer than places like New Zealand have been inhabited. To be English requires this essential racial component. If you can merely identify as English, then it can be dispensed with just as easily. English is something that you are. It is not something that you choose to be.
Yes.
You either are English or you aren't English. And people know, despite all the layers of abstraction and obfuscation, people know.
Yep.
You can tell who is English by looking at him and talking to him, because he looks like an Englishman and he talks like an Englishman.
Wagwan, bruv.
Englishness has a racial starting point. Without them being a distinct race, you could not talk about them in relation to other peoples in pre-modern eras.
Yeah, and both of these points are sort of corollaries of the thing I mentioned the other day, which is that no shitlip would ever accept me going, I'm English all of a sudden, because they go, no, you're Scottish.
Well, it's the whole native, you know, all the classic examples, I'm Native American.
Mm.
Like, no, you're not. It's just...
Smoking peace.
Oh, well, what Native Americans? Are you talking about the Cherokee, you know? Oh, which tribe? There's so many tribes. Native Americans aren't real, guys. Anyway, I hate that that's the conversation people have instead of, you know, just being strident and talking in plain English about the facts. Englishness also has a language, cultural tradition, and religion. Englishness also has language, cultural, traditional, and religious bonds. People people can choose to take on these bonds, and their descendants may eventually become English. But that is a process that will take many hundreds of years, a la the Normans. And as just a final point, England is not England without the English.
And nor are the people within it English without the land below their feet.
Yes. The two work in conjunction. I did want to have a discussion about the fact that you can be ethnically English without being culturally English. You can have the other end of it, in which you basically become, I don't know, a sense of the classic one is like the English Wigger. But you are not culturally English, you are culturally something else.
Mm.
And there is that other component of Englishness in which you need to engage with its traditions, its culture, and its history, and its land.
That cultural product,
yeah.
And the attitudes, the style of dress, the religious ceremonies, the practices, those are the products of the land and the ethnos, yes, being together for so long.
I've got a couple of donations here. Thank you, Webster, for the £2, saying Danny Dyer is a descendant of Willem the Conqueror. I'm not quite sure what the B percent, that might be an error there in syntax. And Coney Current Year say Norman Gang represent.
Whoop, whoop.
That's the thing, though. You can still tell what your ancestry is, really, from your physiognomy in many cases. It's just funny that we talked about the wars and we have all these different phenotypes and things, but it's maybe a bigger discussion than we have time for now. Like, are a lot of people who are currently, you know, ethnically English, residing in England, you know, have they become so degraded that they're no longer culturally English? Mm. I honestly think in my, you know, there is that basic bar of being descended from English peoples.
I think if we were to do it maybe as a Monday stream one day, we can talk about our, and it's going to be a really like fart huffy way to frame it, but our traditional forms in Tropic.
Yes.
Because that gives us a space both to discuss extensions of some of the conversations from Evola and subjects like this.
But to answer the question of who are the English are the English, and they have been the English for a very long time.
And they will continue to be.
If there is any question whether someone is English, he probably is not.
Yeah. Quacks like one, walks like one, looks, tastes like one.
Yes.
Probably is one.
Anyway, thank you guys for coming. We'll do a little bit of shilling here as we usually do.
Yes. We seem to have quite good numbers again this evening. So,
as I will once again do. You can come and listen to us say these things in person. We have our Nomos event in Manchester on the 27th of May. All the tickets for the early bird on the 26th are sold out. Do come see us. We will be speaking. We will have more speaker announcements relatively soon. We did announce Christopher Hansen, the representative for the Mises Institute, who's coming all the way from Stuttgart, I believe. So we have a bit of an international flavour there. Again, thank you to everyone who has donated. There's a little bit here from my deprogramming British democracy, which was my speech from the first Shieldings event. I just wanted to kind of finish on as a little thing. I'm talking here about the ideas that became the English liberal tradition in kind of a sense of Englishness. But it's just, I don't know, I think this is probably one of the better things I've ever written, which is just the fact that the rights of the Englishman to build his shelter, till the earth, raise a family as he sees fit, defend his property, praise his God, and be unmolested by those who would consider themselves his betters, goes back before John Locke's homesteading principle and into the myths of Albion. And that really is kind of the spirit of Englishness. It is so ancient, we don't really know where it all comes from. But throughout history, you can recognize it. And you can certainly recognize who the English are as a people, and what it means to them to be English. Anyway, thank you guys, and good night.
Good night.
That went rather well.